You're listening to UK Health Radio, where health means more than the absence of illness. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. I'm Hillary Burns, and each week we explore honest conversations about life, health, and whole person well-being through real stories of resilience, healing, and human connection. This is the Getting Real with Hillary show on UK Health Radio. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a special guest. Her name is Becky Galli, and she is an author, writer, mother, and columnist. And I happen to have just read her two books. This was her original book, Rethinking Possible. And this one, you got to read this. It's unbelievable. You will not be able to put it down. The second book, I have an advanced reader copy, and it's called Morning Fuel. This will be out in October. And before I bring Becky to the studio, I'm going to just read her introduction. I don't know if I can read it without crying, but that's okay. Here it is. Some would say life has not been kind to me. At age 20, I lost my 17-year-old brother. Two of my four children had special needs. One of my two sons died at age 15. And at 38, 9 days after my divorce was finalized, I was paralyzed by transverse myelitis, a rare inflammation of the spinal cord that affects one in a million. More than once, it's been hard to find the strength to power through and live fully in this life I did not choose. And now, here we go. Becky Galli.
Hi, Hillary.
Hi, I told you I wouldn't get through without crying. But anyway.
It's all done. It's finished. There it is. You know? Teed it up. We're good.
No. Anyone who's ever watched my show knows I cry. So, but anyway, thank you so much for being here. I know, you know, we've put it all out there now, so people will not be surprised. You know, and when you read Becky's book, Rethinking Possible, I mean, you'll just see the kind of childhood she had was just, I would say it was like charmed, right? She had the family that everybody wants. The mother and father got along. They were in love. They kept you, you know, they didn't allow you to go crazy, right? They had discipline, but also with so much love, right? And such good values, right? Your father was, what do you call him? Would you call him a minister or a?
Yes.
Yeah. Minister. So he had his own church and, you know, just they always represented good stuff, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, what do you want to say about your childhood, like when everything was still wonderful and rosy, right?
You know, it's interesting. I knew I had a good childhood, but I think after everything that I've been through, I think it gave me an incredible foundation to be able to handle what life has thrown at me. And I was, you know, at 20, watching your 17-year-old brother, you know, I didn't watch him die, but at that, I was in college and, you know, my dad called me and to let me know that it did not look good. And when he died, it was, you know, like an earthquake in our family. But we didn't fall apart. We did shatter physically. We went to different locations. I was in college. My sister was in high school. Dad had just gotten a new pastorate. And so he was in West Virginia. My mom was in North Carolina. So we shattered physically, but we stay connected. And I think watching my parents cope with the loss of their 17-year-old son is Forrest used to sign his name, your only begotten son. You know, I learned from that things I didn't even know I was learning at the time about coping. And I think it served me well. I'm so grateful for them and all they taught me. And the close-knit family was really by design. You know, we had family Saturdays and dinner times and a lot of structure that created close-knit family. And I think I've taken that with me, and it's been incredibly helpful.
Yeah. When I remember one of the comments you'd said, because you had, was it Saturday dinners or Saturday dinners? And then after your brother passed and your father had taken that football job, I guess he was the chaplain of the football team or something.
Yeah.
And that was on Saturdays. And you were like, what happened to our Saturday, right? That was different, right?
Yes. Yes. You know, he had this this philosophy. I think it took a while. I mean, there's so many stages of loss and grief, and the acute stage. And then I think, you know, the loss is like a, it really is an empty space. And, but what Dad later did, and he did with this Marshall football team, he called it reinvesting your love. Mm-hmm. You know, you have your love for your loved one, and that person isn't there anymore, but you have this love that needs to be invested somewhere or reinvested somewhere. And it's not that you lose it. You know, you're always love, you know, my brother or Dad will always be, you know, his son. But in order to express it, I think that's a wise thing that I've tried to carry forward too, reinvesting the love if you've lost.
And do you think, I mean, I know there's no accidents, but do you think he consciously found the football team? Do you think it found him? Like, how did that happen? You know,
I think sometimes we give it to mystery, give it to forces outside our control. You know, if we're spiritual people, give it to God, you know, that sometimes these things come into our lives and we just know that's the right thing to do. We feel compelled with that. We feel led, and he felt led, and it was a wonderful experience for him.
Yeah, because he didn't do that before that, right? He had no team. Wow, isn't that interesting? And then when your mother finally went out, when did your mother go to join him?
I think he was there about 6 months, maybe 8 months alone, because my sister was finishing up her high school. Okay. And so then they both went up there. So it was a interesting time in their marriage too, to live apart like that when you're so close as they were. That was a lot of learning for both of them, and appreciation of each other in different ways now.
Because he went to wherever he went, I can't remember, but he went after your brother passed, right? Before that,
yeah.
He was just there, right? So then they moved, right? Did they end up selling their house?
Yes. They sold the house and then they moved to West Virginia.
Okay.
From North Carolina.
Wow. And where was the family home? Like the family, the place that they went later on?
That was in North Carolina too. That was Lenore's, where his parents were from that area. And so there was a home place there where after my grandfather passed, we would go back to North Carolina there.
Yeah.
They resided in West Virginia until their death.
Wow. Okay. And then one of the things, I know it's at the end of the book, but I just keep thinking about it. It's instead of taking care of each other, he said, take care of yourself.
Yes. Yes. And that was probably one of the most surprising things, because when he had kidney cancer and it had come back with a vengeance, and we were in the hospital, and we knew, you know, that he wasn't going to be recovering from this bout of it. And we all had hugged together, and Dad had said a prayer, and then he told us, you know, take care of, and we all were expecting it to be each other, and he said yourselves. And I think the truth is that oxygen on your on your face first before your child, when you're on that airplane, if there's turbulence, you can't really take care of each other if you're not healthy yourself. And I think it's a big principle, because to absorb because it's almost you have to lean into that regularly. You know, when you feel spent, it's like, have you taken care of yourself? And then you can take care of others and it'd be more effective.
Yeah. Yeah, that was like, whoa, when I read that, like, you know, yeah, I mean, for me, it's like, it's selfish, you know what I mean? Like, I was always thought, well, it's selfish. You should be taking care of your kids or your mother or whatever. But it's like, no, that's not what he said. And it just makes you stop and think, oh, take care of myself first. Yeah, because you can't be good for everyone else if you're not, like you said. So that was interesting. So after your brother died and you went back to college, I mean, I'm sure that was painful, but were there moments where you forgot and you were just like a regular college kid, you know, just a few moments here and there that you could just, I know how close you were. Did you end up having, what year was that he passed?
1978.
But what year were you?
I was a junior.
A junior, okay.
So it was very interesting because I was a junior in college and my sister was a junior in high school. And so we had very different experiences after we lost Forrest because Rachel and Forrest were just, I think, 18 months apart. And so they were like this tag team, you know, going through high school together, had the same friends. And so Rachel had the comfort, but also the pressing memory of her brother not being there. And at college, people had met Forrest, but they didn't know our family, you know, our whole unit wasn't there. It was just, you know, Forrest is cool and came to visit you. And
right.
So in one sense, Rachel had a lot of support and a lot of knowledge, but in the other sense, she got no relief from that.
Right.
There was no time where she could just be Rachel missing her brother. It's everybody was in grief with her. Mm. And in my situation, I could disconnect from that a little bit easier.
Yeah.
Which on the one hand made it easier because some people didn't, you know, they didn't even know I had a brother or lost a brother. They just, I was, you know, just Becky. My close friends knew and I could cry with them and they would understand it. Some of them had met my mom and dad and come to my home a couple of times. My roommates and suite mates knew that. And it's interesting, after I wrote the book and they read it, they were like, was that there for you? You know, was I there for, and I said, yes, you were. Sometimes it was just like, let's go shopping or let's, you know, go to a movie. And those kind of things was structure. And I think that's so important when you're going through this kind of loss is to have structure and to not isolate and have people around you that can keep you moving through the grief instead of getting stuck in it.
Mm, that's great. Yeah.
And now I think we could take our commercial break. And then when we come back, we'll get the rest of the story. All right.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Good, good.
All right.
All right, moving on. So okay, so then you and Joe get serious and you move together to a new, to, you were with IBM and he was with, always with Black & Decker, right?
Right.
Okay. And then you got married, right?
Yeah, we had apartments next to each other in Charlotte. And then we started dating. And then we got married and moved to Atlanta.
Okay.
And that's
okay.
Where we had our first home.
Wow. Okay. And then you had Brittany when you, no, you worked a few years. I know you were like a workaholic, working, very successful, right?
Yes. Well, workaholic. And yes, we both were. We were kind of good for each other that way. We reined each other in when we were overdoing it, but yes.
Okay. And then how many years later did you have Brittany?
It was so interesting. It she, we were married, I think it was 8 years, right? But we had these goals. My goals were to get a 10-year career in and to have my first child by the time I was 30, and for Joe to get his MBA. So we had all, life was going as planned.
Yeah.
And so we did. Brittany was born when I was 29, and he had finished his MBA, and we had moved to Baltimore by that time. He had transferred, and I was able to transfer my career as well. And so we have a beautiful baby girl.
Wow. And then you managed that with the job, right? How did you do that again?
We had a nanny, a girl that would come in the home and help us with Brittany so I could go to work. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so that, everything was full charging, right? And then when did things start changing? Did you have the miscarriage after Brittany?
I had one miscarriage after Brittany and then another miscarriage after Matthew. Okay. But
yeah, those are hard. I had two of those too, but it was early on. So, I mean, it's still hard, but I didn't realize how many people had them until after I had them. You know, it's not something that people talk about, right?
Right. And it's a huge loss that we really experience in a different way than, the most caring husband in the world doesn't really understand the physical changes your body starts making in preparation for something that doesn't come.
Right. So, okay. So you already had Matthew. So how far apart were Brittany and Matthew? How many years?
Three years.
3 years. Okay. And was Matthew still okay then when you had the miscarriage or?
No. His seizures developed when he was 3 months old.
Okay.
And so, we were going through that and trying to figure out if it was an episode or a long-term situation. It wound up being long, chronic. So we were dealing with that, but we had been told that his situation, because there was something beyond the seizures, there was a degenerative part of this that made it so that he couldn't hit his milestones. So we had genetic testing done, and they had told us that it was, as I say in the book, a fluke, that it wasn't anything that genetically that happened, it was rare, and they encouraged us to go ahead and have additional children if that's what we wanted to do, which we did. We'd always wanted to have 4 kids. And so had another miscarriage, and then I was pregnant with Madison, and she too had, Matthew was healthy at birth and Madison was healthy at birth. And then later on, I was so sensitized to milestones because Matthew was failing at those that I noticed that when Madison's speech wasn't coming in like it should, we had her diagnosed and she had autism. So we were dealing with that, but by the time we got that diagnosis, I was already pregnant with my fourth, Peter. And so it got a little crazy, but I had good help. You know, Joe was very successful, and so I was able to hire the help I needed, and family helped as they could. I was very, very lucky for all that kind of that support. I needed it.
And had you stopped working by then?
I did after Matthew. There was IBM offered a bridge to early retirement, and so I took it. The timing was right, and so yes, I was home.
Yeah. Wow. So, I mean, how, like you say, two special needs. How did you deal with that? I mean, were you just so busy that you just did what you had to do? Did you ever get to process it, or why me, or how this, or, you know, look to see, you know, I think I would have been like, whose fault is this, you know, or whatever. Right. Like, how did you get through that? And I'm sure there's a lot of people with special needs kids out there, you know?
Yes. It's, there's a lot of anger and a lot of trying to figure out where to put that. And, but at the same time, these kids are there and they need you and you need to do things. And it's this odd thing that happens where you're so angry and feel incredibly sad and terrible injustice. And then they cry and they need you, or they need a doctor's appointment, or they need additional medication. So it's almost like their neediness helps you move through that pain. In a really unexpected way. But just looking back, I thought, you know, how did in the world did I do that? But I had good help, and I had, I was in therapy. You know, I can't, you know, I credit Dr. Luco often in Rethinking Possible, and also in Morning Fuel, just for the steadfast guidance. You get good help, you know, mentally, physically. You know, I was trying to work out and at least be outside with the kids, and then spiritual support as well, relying on people. You know, I was angry at God for quite a while. We weren't on speaking terms, but other people prayed for me when I couldn't pray for myself, when I was too angry to pray. I was like, what the heck? Can you pick on another family for a change? I mean, good grief. I think the same thing about, you know, don't isolate and get support and keep structure. And I have this thing, I was like, who, after a while, it's like, I discovered, you know, you can't go through these things alone. So who is in your boat? You know, who is going to help you navigate this storm? And that varies from calamity to calamity, whether it be my own medical condition or my children's medical condition, and the people that can help and help you see straight and be a resource for you. And so it's this ongoing, who can help me? Who can be in this boat with me as I get through this? And to not give up. If somebody turns out to be a dud, you kind of uninvite them, or just don't invite them to the next boat. But it's very important, in my experience, to have good, capable people in there with you as you try to figure it out.
So I think, at least, there's a lot of people, or maybe just me, who, I don't want to ask for help. I think I should be strong. I think I should be able to handle this, or I don't want to let people know that I'm having a hard time, you know, or something. I mean, how was it hard for you to ask for help, or did you just not have a choice, or was that just part of your upbringing? You know, I think, and when you say like, don't isolate, I think there's shame, you know, in some circles for feeling bad or for thinking that you can't handle it or for being angry or something, you know, like, you know, my mother, I love her. She's 94, but her thing is always like, be perky and peppy. So it's like, you weren't supposed to be upset. And, you know, she never asked for help. She's always, you know, she just like amazing, you know? So, you know, when you say who's in your boat, like, was that hard for you, or was that a natural, was that natural from your upbringing to ask for help and to get, ask people to help you and to rely on them, you know?
I think the way Dad would always talk about it would be examine your resources. And in that sense, it isn't necessarily asking for help, but it's knowing where you could go for help. Because I think there's a kind of a qualification process of who you decide to ask for help. This thing we call, you know, appropriate self-disclosure, right? Like, how much do I want to tell this person about it? Can I trust them with everything I need to unload, or a part of what I need to unload? Because, you know, people are human, and you want to make sure that what you share is kept confidential, or, you know, can. And so there's kind of a qualification process, but I think examining your resources, like who can help me if I choose to reach out for them, is worthwhile no matter what. Even if you never pick up the phone, you've got a list, you know? So it's a thoughtful process. It's not, but I do think that I tend to be very independent as much as I can, but when you're paralyzed, guess what? You can't do everything that you want to do. And so, through that and these other kind of losses, you realize that, when you ask for help, it's actually a strength. And I think the strength is being discerning as to which of these resources I can ask for help, and knowing which one, you know, that can really be helpful is a strength. It really is an evaluation strength of yours to say, yeah, I've got these four, but this one's going to be the best here. And it kind of puts your brain into this analytical gear instead of, woe is me, I need rescuing. You know, I don't need rescuing, I need help to get through it, not to feel sorry for me, but to offer suggestions. Now, there's sometimes I just need to cry, you know, my sister knows that. It's like, I just, like, you know, this is terrible. And, you know, she can take it, and I trust her.
Wow. All right. We've got more to come after our commercial break. Thank you so much, Becky, for your courage and your inspiration. So we will be back after a word from our sponsor.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
And now we're going to bring Becky back for the So when did things start going in your marriage? Why don't you talk about
that? Well, I think any time that a family has special needs child or children, it becomes hard to be together in a marriage and problem solve through it. And we tried to resolve the gaps, and we just couldn't do it. And had counseling for 3 years, tried various things, but we both agreed that it would be better to be apart than together. And his support for me continued, though, and his care for me. And he was, there for the children as well. So that was a very tough time, but we made it through, and when we divorced, I wasn't paralyzed. It was only after the divorce that the paralysis came, and Joe was there for me and our family in ways I can still can't believe how supportive he was and how encouraging he was. And even now we're still friends, and our family is close knit again by design and with a lot of effort. Just as my folks showed me how to do that in that family, we've tried to continue that in this family. So
you can't know this,
and you can't write, but
if you had known,
would you have not? Yeah, I saw the part of him that I saw when I married him come back into play after the paralysis. But, we made decisions, and it was time to move through it. And he was willing to help me get through it.
So you never looked back?
Oh, you always look back. Right? You always look back. What is it? You look back, but you don't stare.
Okay, good.
So I don't stare. I was like, yeah, that could have been different, but it didn't. So what are you doing next? It's always about possibility. And I try to minimize regrets, look for possibilities, look back. And if I can learn from it, absolutely. I might stare a smidge, but I'm not going to, you can't rewrite history. You can just rewrite your attitude about it. And that's about it.
When you got paralyzed, I had hope.
Transverse spinalitis is one of those no cause, no cure situations, as is autism, as is epilepsy. And so it's like, here we go again. But I had hope, realistically, because a third of those paralyzed with transverse myelitis recover fully. Another third recover partially. And the last third don't recover at all. So it's like, surely it's my turn to get a break, right? And so you go through with hope that, one of these days I'm going to wake up and I'm going to wiggle that toe. That toe was the last thing that wiggled before I couldn't wiggle anything else. And so every morning I'd get up and try to wiggle that toe, and it wouldn't wiggle. So in the meantime, though, and this is one of the things I've written about both places, actually, I had a therapist that said, when I was trying to figure out with Matthew, was he going to grow out of these seizures or not grow out of these seizures? Was it going to become degenerative or not? She recommended this approach called parallel paths. When you're in uncertainty, you're not sure, it could go either way. She said, pursue both at the same time. The hope that I'm going to recover fully, but the reality that I may not recover at all. And so journeying on both of those paths at the same time enabled me to do things on both sides. I could, on the hope path, keep my body ready to walk, practice standing, do exercises, take all these supplements. On the reality side, I did put some ramps in my house. I considered putting an elevator in my house so that I could, my kids' bedroom were upstairs and I was downstairs. There's no way for me to get upstairs. So this dueling journey allowed me to keep moving forward and being prepared for either one and feel like I was accomplishing things. For me, that's always something. I like to be accomplishing something, And so that technique, that parallel paths, that technique of paralyzed paths, one of them was the parallel paths allows you to keep in motion, which I think is really important as you're moving through any kind of uncertainty to have something to move forward with.
Because you're not fighting it.
And the fight takes a lot of energy. My mom used to say you have 24 buckets of energy a day. How are you going to use them? And we get to decide that every morning we get up, which is part of the reason I wrote Morning Fuel, because my morning times are my times for restoration, for encouragement, for inspiration. And that's when you look as you're writing, you want a lens to look at the book. And it's like, what do I want these things to bring to people's mornings? And it's like, I want either it to inspire, encourage, or make you think. Because those are the three things that I look for in my mornings to be inspired, encouraged, or make me think. And it just kind of depends on how I wake up that day, which of those three I need. And sometimes I need all of them. But getting restored and those buckets of energy fired up for the next 24 hours. And then you have a lot more choices when you have full energy.
Hmm. Did your kids look at you differently, or you were still?
Like Peter was three. They were 3, 4, 6, and 9. And, I don't know. Brittany was 9. And it'd be really interesting now, they're in their 30s. So I don't know what they remember. And what I've come to realize is that what you don't remember still can affect you. Mm. And so I don't know what effect my paralysis had on them. I know that there were many times I would cry just because I couldn't be the kind of mom I wanted to be. I couldn't be down on the ball fields. I watched Peter's soccer games with binoculars from a parking lot if the field was too muddy, and I couldn't do a lot of the things I would want to do with them. But it was really, I figured out how to do the most important things. But it wasn't what I would have wanted. I had to be a different kind of mom. So I don't know what they would say. It'd be interesting what book they would write.
Yeah. Especially Brittany, I think.
Yeah. She's a tough cookie. She is.
Yeah.
And they've seen a lot, and my hope would be, just as I watched my parents go through the grief of losing their son and what I learned from them about resilience and about moving through grief, that maybe something of their experience could be helpful to them as they go through life. Because very few of us make it through unscathed without some kind of loss that redirects us in a direction we didn't want to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Becky, I'm going to let you talk about your community
and what you want
want to join because I have this echo that's making me crazy. do you mind?
Do you mind? No, not at all.
Go ahead.
So, yes, I would love to have your audience become part of my audience and join my subscriber family. I do a little email called Thoughtful Thursdays, where on Thursdays, not every Thursdays, but a lot of Thursdays. It used to be every week, but now I've kind of given myself a little grace and with the books coming out. Yes, and that's at BeckyGalli.com, BeckyGalli.com. And there's a way you can sign up to be join my subscriber family. I would love to have you. Of course, I'd love for you to buy my book and the one that's coming out in October. And there's a way to do that on my website as well. I've been writing columns for, 25 years now. And a lot of them are on my website. If you just want to, there's a search bar at the top. You can put in anything you want and see what pops up. It might be helpful to you. I'd love that.
All right. Awesome.
Okay.
I have an echo, everyone. That's why I'm driving me crazy. So, Becky, how would you like to see the world in your inspiration?
Can you say that again? You were kind of breaking up.
What's your vision for the world?
Oh, dear. That's a loaded question. My vision for the world? You know, there's a piece I wrote in, actually it's in both books. I loved it so much. It was to Brittany and Brian on their wedding day. And it was about how to love. And my message to them was to let your love be larger. Let your love be larger than the situation, than who's right or wrong. And I just wish we could figure out ways to love one another in a non-judgmental way that could be inclusive, supportive, and work for the common good of humanity. You know, and I think love is really the key to that, to figure out what that means in a practical way. For everybody to let their love be larger.
That's beautiful.
And what's one lesson
that you have learned?
I think the most important thing when you're facing something unexpected is to be honest with yourself, what you're feeling, what the circumstance is, what your resources are, and to not deny reality, even though it's something you don't want to accept. And maybe you don't have to at the moment, but even acknowledge, I don't know what this is. I don't know what this means. To even say, I don't know out loud. And just be very honest about life and about your feelings, because that matters and how you get through it.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Read it.
Yes. Thank you.
Pre-order this. And thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Getting Real with Hillary show on UK Health Radio. If today's conversation resonated with you, take a moment to reflect, share, or simply be with what you heard. Until next time, this is Hillary Burns, inviting you to stay curious, stay connected, and keep getting real.